So our first speaker for the afternoon is going to be Claire Wu from UC Berkeley. So Claire is working with John Frusche and his lab, and he's going to be talking about material design and processing for charge transport in organic electronics. So Claire, please.
Thanks, Jeff, for the introduction. Like you said, I'm Claire, and I'm a graduate student in Professor Frusche's group. And today, I am going to talk about the influence of material design and material processing on the charge transport in organic electronic materials. So most of you have seen this kind of schematic before, showing the operating mechanism of an organic OPV device. The four main steps are light absorption, creating an exciton diffusion to a donor-acceptor interface, then the dissociation of an exciton into free charges, and then finally charge transport. And for today, I'm primarily going to focus on the challenge of charge transport. Now, there are two main parameters that affect this step, and previous speakers this morning have also touched on this. And the first parameter is morphology. Given the finite lifetime of charges in organic semiconductors, we need continuous and percolated pathways for efficient charge extraction. And the second parameter is solid-state packing, which is often believed to heavily influence the charge carrier mobility of organic materials. And so today I'm going to talk mainly about three projects that look to use different methods of tuning mobility and charge transport in organic materials. The first project is going to look at side chain modification on a low band gap polymer to improve its microstructural order. The second project looks at post-fabrication treatments such as photocrosslinking and thermal annealing to tune the crystallinity of a bromine P3 sheet derivative. And then the third project, we're going to talk about pre-alignment of polymer chains into nanoparticles for morphology control. Now, before we can, you know, consider charge transport, we need to have a system that absorbs light and creates charges. And it's now fairly common in the design for conjugated polymers to use a combination of an electron-rich unit with an electron-deficient unit to achieve orbital hybridization and lower your band gap and increase your absorption. So in doing this kind of design, we came up with this backbone that contains this benzyl diethiophene BDT as the electron-rich unit. And we chose it because it has several advantages. It is symmetric, so there's no region regularity effect. Its large fused ring system is optimal for pi stacking, which is often good for charge transport. And importantly, it has shown good performance in combination with other electron deficient units, such as in this polymer here that has achieved one of the highest efficiency reported today for OPVs. Now, for the acceptor electron deficient unit, we have chosen this cyanopyrrolidione, or TPD, unit. And again, it's symmetric, and it has two electron withdrawing carbonyls to give it electron efficient character. And it has the right energy levels to achieve this orbital hybridization with BDT. And importantly, we have devised a synthetic method to alkyl-functionalize this R group here on TBD that allows us to study the effect of side chain on device performance. And I should also mention that around the same time that we were working on this, two other groups reported on the same backbone and same polymer, and both of them reported very decent performance. But what I'm going to tell you today, though, is on the importance of the solubilizing group. Now, the solubilizing group, as its name suggests, affects the solubility of the polymer and thus its processability. But the solubilizing group also affects the structural properties of the polymer and its miscibility with PCBM, both of which influence the ultimate device performance. And in fact, a careful study correlating alkyl functionalization with device performance has yet to be done with low band gap polymers. And we thought that with this TPD-BTD backbone, it could serve as a good platform for doing this kind of study. And using the same schematic, the same synthetic method, we synthesized a family of three polymers, P1, P2, and P3, with different solubilizing chains on the TPD unit. And these three polymers all have similar molecular weights in PDI. Now, before I show you the device performance, first we would like to confirm that we haven't compromised or changed the optical and electronic properties of the polymer too much. Right? We have kept the same backbone. Changing the side chain shouldn't really change these optical electronic properties. And as we expected, these three polymers have similar absorption spectra and similar HOMO levels of around 5.5 EV and an optical band gap of 1.7 EV, and these energy levels are appropriate for achieving charge transfer with PCBM. Now, after a lot of device optimization, these are the best results that we obtained for the three polymers in bulk heterojunction solar cells with PCBM. In P1, which is arguably the most bulky side chain, it's an ethyl hexyl group, the device efficiency is 4%. Now, when we moved to a dimethyl octyl in P2, the efficiency jumped to 5.7%, mostly with an increase in JSE and fill factor. Then furthermore, when we got rid of all the branching and just used a straight octyl side chain in P3, the efficiency improved even more to 6.8%. And this results clearly indicate that the choice of the solubilizing group is critical in determining the device performance. The question is, why? Why do the solubilizing groups matter? What is happening in the nanoscale? We looked at these polymer blends with PCBM under grazing incidence X-ray scattering. And the first thing that we noticed is that all three polymers actually have adopt a face-on orientation. This means that the backbone is parallel to the substrate, and the pi-pi stacking distance is perpendicular to the substrate. And this should be favorable for vertical charge transport out of the device. But comparing the three samples, what we notice is that this pi stacking peak, this peak up here, increases in intensity from P1 to P2 and finally to P3. And this is indicative of more pi stacking in P2 and P3. Another observation we had is that the pi stacking distance, which we denote by D2 here, is smaller in P2 and P3. And so we believe that these two reasons, the tighter pi stacking distance and the increased microstructural order in P2 and P3 are the main reasons for their improved performance. And this also correlates very well with our mobility measurements of these polymers, showing increasing mobility from P1 to P2 and furthermore to P3. So in this study, we see that changing the side chain is one way to improve microstructural order. And it is a good approach to make a good material even better. But you might think, well, you know, I don't want to change the side chain every time I want to change my, every time I want to tune the microstructural order. And in fact, the most traditional way of tuning crystallinity is using post-fabrication treatments such as solvent annealing and thermal annealing. And this has been done very extensively with the P3HT PCBM system. But it is also well known that the system is not very stable. And again, our speakers this morning have touched on this, that when the system is exposed to heat for a long time, it exhibits this kind of macrophage separation that is really not ideal. And in tackling this problem, our group recently developed this bromine P3HT derivative that is photocrosslinkable. And so it crosslinks and allows locking in of the morphology upon UV irradiation. And what we found was that if we just incorporate a small amount of this bromine-containing monomer into the P3HT, between 5 to 20%, we can maintain a high device efficiency, as you see here, that all the bromine derivatives actually show similar, very comparable performance as the control P3HT device. And more importantly, cross-linked bromine P3HT devices show very stable device performance. You see here that the efficiency is stable up to 50 hours of annealing at an elevated temperature of 150 degrees. And in contrast, the control P3HT device degrades very quickly. And under optical microscopy, we see that the morphology is very stable after it's been cross-linked, whereas in the non-cross-linked film, we see these micron-sized PCBM crystals developing, which other people have also seen before. Now, but what is interesting about this bromine P3HT material is that because the cross-linking is done by UV radiation, now we can independently optimize the cross-linking and the thermal annealing process, right? And so we can actually study how cross-linking affects the packing of P3HT without the influence of heat. We're also interested in looking at how if we can use different processing conditions to control the packing of this polymer. And so we chose five different processing conditions, an F-cast film, a cross-linked film, an annealed film, and then a sample that is first cross-linked and then annealed, and finally a more interesting condition where we cross-link and anneal the film at the same time. So just to study the effect of these processing conditions on the charge transport properties of this polymer, we looked at the performance of the bromine P3HT in FETs. And here I'm just showing the comparison between the S-cast sample and the annealed sample. And we see clear improvements in the on-off ratio in the threshold voltage as well as in the overall mobility. Now, this is not so surprising. Many people have seen this before. But when we look at the cross-link samples, the results are more interesting. In the just cross-link film, we actually see that the current doesn't saturate. And this poor saturation behavior is indicative of charge conduction happening away from the semiconductor dielectric interface. However, if we anneal the film that is cross-linked, we recover these saturation behavior and can extract a mobility of about 2.5 times 10 to minus 4 centimeters squared per volt second. Now, what's more interesting is that if we anneal and cross-link the film at the same time, we see a huge jump in the mobility with an increase of over an order of magnitude. And so all these results tell us that the FET performance is highly, highly dependent on the processing conditions. Now, just to show you a summary of all of these mobility measurements, plotting them on the same graph, these five processing conditions led to mobilities of that range over two orders of magnitude. And what is the most interesting observation so far is that the order of the cross-linking and thermal annealing matters a lot. And we suspect that these differences are probably due to differences in the crystallinity of the thin film. So we proceeded to look at these films under X-ray scattering again. And these are the 2D grazing instance X-ray scattering patterns of the five different samples. And the first thing that you will notice is that they kind of all look the same, right? They basically have the same packing motifs, the same very similar crystal orientation, and in fact, they all have the same lattice spacings. So this means that the processing did not change the overall crystal structure, right, in the film. But what we want to look at, though, is are there differences in the intensity of these peaks, right? Unfortunately, you cannot just look at this peak and this peak and compare the absolute intensity for several reasons. These are this particular measurement is kind of low resolution, and also there are variations in beam footprint, and this measurement, the grazing instance measurement, it leads to inaccuracies in this region where the QXY is zero. So what we need to do, and this is a rather recently developed X-ray analysis technique, what we need to do is combine the grazing incidence measurement with two additional measurements, which are called rocking curves, to get a more accurate reading of the peak intensity in this region here, where QX is zero. And combining the three scans, we can get the so-called pole figure. And the pole figure basically captures all the crystalline regions in your film as a function of crystal orientation with respect to the substrate. And this is indicated by an angle dependence, so which we call chi. Okay? And you can do this for really any crystalline peak, but the easiest is to use the strongest peaks. And so here it would be the 100 peak for P3HT and the 200 peak. So doing this analysis, I just show here for simplicity the comparison between the S-cast and the annealed film. And clearly we see that the annealed film is more crystalline than the S-cast film. And this is confirmed by both the 100 and the 200 Poe figure. And also what is good is that the angle, the chi dependence, is also similar in the 100 and the 200 Poe figure. So this is good that, you know, our data at least is consistent. But doing this sort of analysis, the Poe figure analysis, for all five samples in the five different processing conditions, we get this master graph where I plotted the relative crystallinity of the five samples and also the mobility of the five samples. And what we see is basically that the mobility correlates very well with the degree of crystallinity. Basically, the higher crystallinity you have, the higher mobility you get. Okay. But we can also make other general observations that was kind of interesting. One, the cross-linking doesn't seem to damage the crystallinity of your film. Okay. But if you anneal the film after you cross-link, it basically has very little effect. And you can kind of expect it, right? You cross-link the film, it doesn't move anymore. You have locked everything in. But we have discovered one way to improve this, basically by cross-linking and annealing the film at the same time, to recover some crystallinity and mobility. Okay? So with this study, I've shown that we could use post-fabrication treatments to tune the crystallinity of a bromine P3HT thin film. However, thermal annealing or cross-linking may not be effective on certain polymers. And so we have to look at other ways to manipulate these polymers. And one way is to use nanoparticles. And basically using this is basically a pre-fabrication treatment. And it's attractive because if you can find a universal method to make size-controlled nanoparticles, you basically have a general route for controlling morphology. And in fact, this has been attempted before by other groups using techniques such as mini-emulsion, to make using two immiscible solvents and surfactants to make semiconducting nanoparticles. Other groups have also drafted P3HT onto inorganic nanoparticles to make inorganic-organic hybrid nanoparticles. But the synthesis that I'm going to talk about today uses a nanoprecipitation method that allows us to make surfactant-free nanoparticles. And what we do is that we first dissolve the polymer in a good solvent. So, for example, P3HT and chloroform. Then we introduce this solution very, very slowly, basically drop-wise, into a big beaker of non-solvent, such as ethanol for P3HT. And this induces the formation of P3HT nanoparticles in as a stable colloidal suspension in the ethanol. And in fact, we have done this for a variety of different semiconducting polymers, including many different P3HTs, the bromine P3HT that I just mentioned, MEH PBV, cyano PBV. We have also made blend nanoparticles containing both PCBM and P3HT. But for today, I'm going to focus mostly on the two kinds of particles made from commercial Riki P3HT and a Grimm P3HT made in-house by our own group. When we were making these Riki particles and Grimm particles, what we noticed is that the biggest factor that determines the size of the nanoparticles is the initial polymer concentration. Basically, the more concentrated solution you have initially, the bigger particles you get. Right? Now, what is interesting, though, is that the two different kinds of P3HT, despite having different molecular weights, region regularity, and polydispersity, actually show very similar particle size. Right? And so this tells us that the particle size is really not so dependent on these polymer characteristics. But we do see subtle differences between the Grimm particles and the Riki particles. Basically, you see that the Grimm particles are more irregular in shape. They have kind of sharper edges, whereas the Riki particles are more spherical in shape. And we believe that this is due to the more monodispersed nature of Grimm P3HT, which also we believe is more crystalline than the Riki P3HT. There are also differences in the optical properties of these particles. Basically, you see that there are more vibronic structures in the Grimm particles. The shoulder is also stronger, and these are indicative of more pi-pi stacking in the Grimm particles. And I'd like to also mention that the absorption of the particles are much more redshifted compared to solvated P3HT chains. Basically, anyone who has worked with P3HT know that it's orange in solution, but these particles are actually dark purple in solution, basically like a P3HT thin film. Now, since there were differences in optical properties, we thought there may also be differences in their diffraction. But we actually see that the lattice spacing of the nanoparticles are basically the same as the thin film, which was kind of surprising to us. Right? So basically, confining these chains into nanoparticles did not really change the lattice motif. However, we do see that there are differences in the crystal orientation. So basically, the both of the particles have more isotropic orientation. So you see that this arc is more uniform over all angles, whereas in comparison, if you look at the thin film, you have more of this arcing, so more anisotropic orientation. And this is what you would expect if the particles do retain their spherical-like shape on in a thin film form, so on a substrate. So we wanted to test and see if making these nanoparticles, have we maintained their electronic properties. We tested them in FETs, and we see here in this table that the nanoparticles actually have very comparable electronic properties to the corresponding thin film. So we haven't really compromised their electroactive behavior. And we also tested these particles in solar cells. So these solar cells are made by spin coating the particles onto P-dot ITO substrates and then spin coating PCBM on top using an orthogonal solvent. And you see that the nanoparticle device are a lot better than the control bilayer device that is just done with two smooth films of P3HT and PCBM. And the nanoparticle device actually have an efficiency of 2.2%, which is actually one of the highest for nanoparticle-containing organic OPVs. So, in summary, I have shown you three ways to manipulate the active layer morphology and the solid-state packing of organic semiconductors. First project we looked at uses sidechain engineering to increase the microstructural order of a low band gap polymer, achieving up to 6.8% efficiency. The second project studied a photocrossingable bromine P3HT derivative and we used post-fabrication treatments such as thermal annealing and cross-linking to tune the microstructural order in the film. And lastly, we used we made polymer nanoparticles by a nanoprecipitation method, and we have confirmed its electroactive behavior. So I'd like to thank Professor Schaaf for the opportunity to work in this group, Dr. Justin Miner for running the group, and then a lot of our team members that have who have contributed to a lot of this work, Claudia, Tom, Jess, Pierre, Jill, and Dave, and the rest of the solar team, Mark, Olivia, Alan, Bongsu, and John Markle. And I'll also like to thank Mike Tony from SSRL, who have helped with a lot of the XRD measurements, and of course, CAUS and DOE for funding. Riki is a commercial P3HT. It's made by a company called Riki, and it's their proprietary. Well, I think it might be proprietary, or they use this Riki catalyst, I think. And then GRIM is a granular metathesis. Stands for granular metathesis. It's a different kind of synthetic method for making P3HT.
Can you explain how this PMP, the last one that you showed, how does it work? I didn't understand how it works at the solar cell. Where are the electron hole pair generated? How they are getting to the respective contact? Can you just guide me through that?
Right. So we have a layer of particles, right, on the p-dot. Okay. So actually, sorry, we have P dot, and we actually sprinkle a very, very thin layer of P3HT as a buffer layer.
Okay.
Maybe 5 nanometer, 5, 10 nanometer.
5, 10 nanometer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we spin coat the nanoparticles on top of this buffer layer.
How big are the nanoparticles?
The particles can range in size from 20 nanometer to 100 nanometer. And these were done, I think, with maybe probably about 50-60 nanometer particles.
It's like a bilayer, but one of the layers have nanoparticles.
Yeah, so I guess you can, so it's like a bilayer, you can say.
Now, if it is so thin, then light absorption will be minuscule, right? So how is your efficiency?
Well, I mean, the overall thickness would be about 80 nanometer, which is not so much thinner than, you know, an optimal P3HT-PCM device.
Is it the nanoparticles that are absorbing
the light? The nanoparticles doing most of the light absorption, right.
And it will not be shorted with the 5 nanometer?
No, because we have particles on top of the buffer layer. So the buffer layer is mostly so that actually, in your talk, you talk about, you know, not having PCBM, like not having one material touch both electrodes, right? So that's mostly the reason for putting down this buffer layer. And it's really important for particles because they have void spaces. And so if I'm spin coating PCBM, you know, it can just go into the void space. So that's why we put down this buffer layer.
This layer function is blocking.
For this buffer, for the buffer layer.
So you essentially have a buffer layer of the PCBM on top too, just by depositing it.
Right, because we're depositing a second, or third.
Yeah. So for the cross-linking, can you control the speed? I mean, so you cross-link and the thermal linking at the same time, right?
Right.
But the speed of the cross-linking really depends on the power of the UV light you use, right?
Yeah.
If you change the power of the UV light, you might see different.
Correct.
Go
yeah, no, I mean, you're right. And we haven't done a careful study on that, but we know that it is heavily, you're right, it heavily depends on the intensity of the light that you use. And if you use a very, very strong light, I mean, so far we've only used these TLC lamps, right, that we use in a chemistry lab. And so for those lamps, it takes, you know, somewhere between 10 minutes to an hour to cross-link, depending on how many bromine units, right, you know, you have. And I mean, just like also in parallel with annealing, you know, the longer you anneal, right, the more crystalline regions develop, right? So yeah, it's all a time dependence too.
We played around with some of these materials.
Right.
I mean, do you anneal when you do this, or do you do this at all?
For the particles or the?
Yeah, the particles.
No. So the selling point, right, is that we don't have to do any post-fabrication treatment. So these are not annealed at all.
Okay. I was just curious. I mean, we can see diffusion of polar ink across the layers.
Yeah.
It's pretty mild temperature.
Yeah, but these are not, there's no post-treatment.
One quick question. The first part of your talk, what was the band gap of the polymer?
Around 1.7 EV.
1.7. And so do you think you can go lower than that?
Absolutely, yeah. We're working on that, yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot, Clara. That's a nice talk.